720 WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us today and sharing part of your Saturday with me. I'm always most grateful to you for that. Lots to do on the show today. Many, many things to talk about. We are going to be talking a little bit later in the show about manufacturing medical devices outside the U.S. and what that means tax-wise and all that good stuff, because it is really kind of fascinating when you start breaking it all down. And we're going to be talking about ecotourism and how to travel more mindful of the environment. And we're going to be talking about how, you know, reconciling this idea of like ESPN versus the cord cutters, right? A lot of people getting rid of cable and using online programming, but how that works with sports programming is a little bit different than a lot of other shows that we watch. So we're going to be talking about that. But to kick things off, I want to talk about a big, big story that's been going on this past week. And that is really all about this discussion around internet privacy. So there's, you know, as the federal government rolls back internet privacy regulations, all these things have been proposed. Illinois is leading this pushback among a lot of other states with this groundbreaking bill to aimed at anyway, increasing protection of personal information. So there's a lot going on with that piece. And I think when we talk about it, it gets a little bit oversimplified. So joining us now to help us make sense of all of it is Connor Daugherty, reporter at New York Times. Hi, Connor. Thanks for being with us today.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thanks so much for taking the time on a Saturday. So, you know, as this conversation has kind of gone and quickly spun up online, especially as with many news stories, right, things get reduced to 140 characters and information moves really quickly, but sometimes it's a bit oversimplified. So if you could take us through a bit of the highlights that perhaps the main narrative is overlooking when we talk about all of these regulations.
Oh, wow. That's a lot. Well, there's a, you know, the old adage, I don't know if it's old, but it is by now, that if you are getting a product for free, you are the product being sold.
Right.
And so the question is, the main question, it seems, in Illinois is, should consumers have the right to know what exactly is being collected on them and who it's being sold to? There are some other laws that you guys are talking about, but I think that that's the biggest one.
Yes.
And it's a big one because it's been talked about in several other places. California, I believe Minnesota may have done something similar. And perhaps more importantly, people in Europe already get it. And the reason that's important isn't because we have to be like Europeans or anything. It's because we more or less know that Facebook, Google, and all these companies that are, for the most part, the dominant online advertising companies are already capable of doing this and have presumably set up whatever systems they need to make this possible for consumers. And so I think that you know, it's kind of hard. It's a difficult position for them to be in because it's kind of hard to argue that European consumers should, for some reason, have something that Americans don't have, or that it's impossible to give because it's already been given. You know, so I think that when I listen to everything at your legislature, that's the one that seems to be the biggest deal. I think the rest of them, there was one about when companies, in what instances companies should be able to track you on your phone, you know, your location, and then some other ones. But I think that they mainly have to do with, like, consent.
Right, right. Well, it is interesting. I mean, as we look to European consumers, because I feel like this is a kind of familiar trope. We saw this with Facebook and Google. Even a couple of years ago, I think Google and French newspapers really stand out, because I feel like that's where it really started to hit a lot of U.S. News outlets when French journalists were kind of pushing back against appearing in Google News and what that meant and to have a Google ad pointing at a paper, things like that. And then this big story, I think it was in Ireland where it was officially happening, but around Facebook and privacy I think probably 2 years ago. And I mean, we saw that also in like skincare and chemicals in food and things like that. So it seems like we often are looking to European consumers around, you know, consumer protection issues, whether we want to admit it or not. They seem a bit ahead of us in that way.
They're certainly ahead of us on privacy. I don't want to be in a position where I'm sort of implying Europe's better because, you know, there are different ways people, you know, they're, you know.
We've all got our stuff.
Straight off the other way.
Right.
But they obviously take privacy a lot more seriously, and there are some historical reasons for that. They've, you know, had some trouble with wars, you know, a few decades ago. And so they take it very seriously. And, you know, whether or not that's good or bad, they obviously have a lot more rights because it's just much more, I mean, forget about the law. It's just very much in their DNA to be, I mean, I had a French friend who like got really mad at me for even mentioning them on Facebook. You know, they take it, you know, even at a cultural level, they're very serious about it. So that's, back to America and Illinois.
Yeah.
I think that if you just like go, you asked about the regulatory framework, like forget about all the laws and forget about what's really happening is almost like something sort of like the environmental movement where, you know, it started off in a few states and it started off with a few regulations and then it multiplied and then it, you know, industry people would say metastasized, but eventually it ended up with an EPA that many industry people were sort of happier about because they'd rather have one giant federal regulator they have to deal with than like 100 states. And I think that something sort of like that is probably the end game of all this because you have, you know, Illinois, big state, California, big state, to a lesser extent, Texas. You have these states that no company could really design a product around just that state, you know, looking towards internet regulations. And I think that as all these states start to come up with new things, we'll start to see some kind of consensus around what kinds of privacy rights people have, because it will just be too difficult for any one company, particularly these companies that need, you know, tens of millions of consumers to, you know, because they make whatever, a half a penny per, you know, ad or whatever, they're just going to need some kind of universal law, if that makes sense.
Right.
So I think that, you know, Illinois is not important except insofar as it's, I mean, it's important because Illinois is a big and important state, but it's when you combine it with all those other states that you start to have companies just go, well, you know, we kind of have to obey all these laws because we just can't have this multiplying.
Right, right. And it's interesting, too, how this particular issue around online privacy seems to be this kind of magical unicorn of an issue that is a uniter across party, which is not something we see very often.
That's totally true. In fact, totally as a subplot to all this, I've become fascinated with this and other issues, how we have this kind of like libertarian-ish sort of thinking around privacy, and then we have this like kind of classic liberal thinking around privacy, and then the people who seem the most conflicted are kind of like your moderate Democrat, mid-level Republican who are, for lack of a better term, pro-business, you know, like where they're just looking for, where they're very conscious of how to, you know, reduce costs and regulatory burdens on businesses. So it's actually kind of, I've seen this in other issues that I shall not get into, but I guess in some ways that kind of reflects the times we're in where we have, you know, people who are very on the, like, kind of, for lack of a better term, like liberty, freedom, like spectrum of
sure,
conservative thinking, and then the kind. But yeah, no, it's a fascinating thing. I mean, I think also privacy is one of these like really weird things that it's not entirely clear what the damage is. We haven't had like like a 3 mile island grade privacy disaster. I suppose, you know,
right.
Depends on how you define that, but, you know, we've had hacking problems that have been huge. We've had things like that, but I don't know that we can point to someone saying like, oh, you know, Google knew that I searched for diapers and it somehow completely ruined my life later.
Right.
So, but on the other hand, it just makes people uncomfortable that all this stuff is being collected about them. And I guess it's a weird issue because we all sort of know this is happening and we all sort of wish we knew a little bit more, but we all sort of feel like we kind of can't do anything about it short of completely disconnecting from the world and becoming like someone who walks around with, you know, a mask on and sends things by carrier pigeon.
Right. And, it's the modern world. So we have to log in. Right.
Yeah. It's like this weird thing. And so I don't know where it ends up, but it's obvious that people are thinking about it and maybe one day there will be, Snowden is the closest we've come to this, there will be some calcifying moment where everyone goes, oh, we need this.
Yeah, I was just going to say, Snowden seemed like things were going to go a certain direction there, but we still kind of remains to be seen how his story ends indeed. Well, thank you so much, Connor Daugherty from New York Times. We'll continue to turn to you for this and many, many other issues as this has the Senate, this has cleared the Senate and it's going to the House here soon. So thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
All right, we're going to take a little break, and when we come back, we are going to be talking about how ESPN and not using cable are not really working out, right? A lot of people cutting the cord, moving to online-based viewing. Well, it's kind of weird when you get into sports, so we're going to talk about that when we come back here on 720 WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with me. I hope you are also planning on spending some time outside because it is gorgeous out there, my friends. Still lots to do on the Business Lunch today. I want to shift. We were just talking about online privacy. I want to shift to talk a bit about how more and more people are getting rid of cable and using, you know, internet-based programming solutions in their households. And that presents kind of an interesting spot, an interesting gray area when it comes to sports programming. Joining us to talk about that is a reporter at Bloomberg, Ira Boudway. Welcome to the program, Ira.
Thank you for having me on.
Thanks for joining us. So just a few years ago, it seemed like ESPN built this just monster digital facility or monster, I'm sorry, broadcast facility and, you know, invested multi-millions into it and really just kind of, I think at the time, a lot, the word future proof was being thrown around a lot, not just in broadcast, but in, you know, digital media and certainly in other, you know, news outlets were using that word a lot. And then suddenly, I think no one could foresee the shift that broadcast would make. But nonetheless, sports is still kind of in this limbo, purgatory area. So tell us about that, if you would.
Yeah, I mean, even while a lot of programming on broadcast and on cable started to atrophy because people could watch it when they felt like it rather than watching it when the broadcasters decided to put it on, sports seemed immune to that problem. And so it actually became more valuable because every cable channel, every programmer wanted a piece of some live sport rights. And ESPN had been doing this for longer and better and had a lot of money. And so they seemed to be in great position because they got out and grabbed a lot of sports rights, Monday Night Football, NBA playoffs, Major League Baseball. They had something year-round pretty much every night they can show you a game. And so they seemed like this fortress in the world of cable where everything was falling apart. But then in the last 5 years, they've also seen their subscriber base decline. People are just choosing to not get cable, or they're choosing to get cable bundles that don't include ESPN because it's the most expensive piece of your bundle.
Right, right. And I think more and more people want different kinds of sports programming. They're not necessarily after the most mainstream thing. And more, we don't live where we grew up. So our sports, you know, allegiances might not be the game that's being shown in our market. I think more and more people want to watch something in a different market or even a global market, you know, as other sports that aren't really aired in the U.S. so much have gained popularity here. I think that seems like an issue, too.
Yeah, I mean, they're competing in a way with their partners, the leagues. The leagues, you know, especially Major League Baseball and the NBA, who have a lot of games to show, less so the case with the NFL, where it's a pretty, you know, 16-game season. They're all on broadcast. But for Major League Baseball and the NBA and a lot of other sports, they have their own networks or their own ways of bringing the games to you directly, and you can subscribe to packages that allow you to watch out-of-market games. ESPN's proposition is different. These are the games that we think everyone across the country might have some interest in. These are the marquee matchups. And that is still powerful because advertisers love the idea of a broad, especially men who are sometimes hard to find in large numbers, tuning into something at the same time, something that creates some urgency. And so advertisers like it, but there were a lot of people who were getting ESPN who maybe don't really care enough about it or don't care about it to the tune of $8 a month. And so that's where ESPN now finds its revenue a little bit constricted.
Right, right. And so what does it seem like they're going to propose to kind of stem the bleeding there as more and more people are bailing out on ESPN cable packages?
They're doing a couple things. One, they are going in on all of the so-called virtual bundles, the cable bundles like Sling and YouTube. Google just put one out. Hulu is about to put one out. There's one called Sony's PlayStation View. And these look a lot like cable. You pay for something. It's over the internet. It's a bundle of channels. You pay maybe $20 to $50 for it, but there's no contract. There's no commitment. There's no equipment. Those bundles all include ESPN because you really can't build something that's going to attract any customers still without that brand, without that. It says you're going to get sports. It says this is a quality package. And so they've been able to get into all those bundles, and they charge those carriers, those service providers, the same that they charge your traditional cable providers. It's like $7 a month if you want to get ESPN in this package, you know, per subscriber. And so they're doing that, but that's not on a big enough scale yet to replace the people who are getting rid of traditional cable. But they think that that's one possibility. And they're just trying to sort of improve what they deliver to their subscribers by making it available mobile, by making it available on their TVs in ways that they can see a massive menu of programming rather than just a single channel of what's on this hour, what's on the next hour. You know, even if you're using DirecTV, you can access a menu that will show you, okay, here's what's on ESPN, but also here's a bunch of stuff that we can stream you, you know, that comes included with your subscription. So they're trying to make the value proposition a little bit better, and they're trying to be on every bundled pay TV service they possibly can.
It is really interesting, especially when you factor in the special circumstance of sports programming, is that it's very expensive to carry games. And that's why, you know, the ad revenue coming in attached to games, that's why it works out and has worked out for so long, which seems like we might enter kind of a period of where sports broadcast and consumer habits changing, all that's going to swirl together for kind of an unsteady, you know, maybe it might be a very brief period, but it seems like it might be a little unsteady for a minute as people are all figuring out kind of this new model. It's really very interesting. So thank you so much, Ira Boudjoué, reporter at Bloomberg, for helping us break it down. I will tweet out a link to your story after because it's really, really filled with a lot of great information. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you again for having me.
Thank you. All right, we're going to take a little break. We're going to get you to news, all that good stuff. WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thank you for being with us today and sharing part of your weekend. Most grateful to you for that. Still lots to do on the show, lots of things to talk about. You know, the topics I really love, well, I love all the topics, but one thing I really love is to take something that seems like a small detail and put it in context to reveal that it is, in fact, much bigger than we think. And one of those details that might seem like a thing we would overlook and take for granted is medical supplies. Did you know that about 30% of medical supplies and devices in this country are all imported from elsewhere? Okay, you're thinking, and so what? Here's the thing. As we talk more and more about how tax is figured into that, as we have, let's say, changing relationships with different countries under the new administration, well, suddenly all of that matters. So here to talk with us about that is Sarah Varney, who is a national health policy reporter at Kaiser Health News. Hi, Sarah. Thanks for being with us today.
Thanks for having me, Amy.
Well, so this is one of those topics, right? We think, okay, medical supplies, they're everywhere. There's lots of stores that carry them. No big deal. Easy to get. But in fact, once we start looking at where we're getting them and our relationships with those countries and taxes we are imposing at different borders, suddenly it gets quite complicated and quite political.
Absolutely. So this is a story that is in today's New York Times, where I went down to Tijuana, Mexico, to look at this issue. So as you mentioned, about 30% of the medical devices and supplies that come into the United States are imported. Much of that is from Mexico. Some of it's from Ireland, from China. And it's incredibly complex, right? So think about somebody with a pacemaker, for instance. My father has a pacemaker. There are components of that pacemaker that are likely made in Tijuana, Mexico, and then brought back into the United States to be put back together. It might have metals that are coming from China. It might have, you might have another medical device that has an LCD display that's made in Taiwan or in Singapore. So even just within one very small device, you might have parts of that device that are brought in from four or five different countries and then, you know, soldered in Mexico and then brought back into the United States and put together.
Very complex. I mean, even as you note in the story that's in the New York Times, suturing needles from Ireland, like things that we would completely take for granted. Where it starts getting even more complicated then is, you know, as we start to look at regulations that have to be on top of any facility that would make these devices and how long it takes to get them. So if any of these manufacturing facilities were to be moved back into the U.S., well, suddenly there's a bit of a threat to the access for these materials because it would take potentially quite a long time to get back up to speed and back up to code with all these regulations.
Yeah, the global supply chain for medical devices is a well-oiled machine, and you know it requires FDA approval at plants in China and in Singapore and in Mexico and in Costa Rica. You know, you have to imagine that any time you made any, even just the slightest change to the design of a component of a pacemaker, for instance, you know that has to be approved by regulatory bodies. And we've seen over time when you know different places would in around the world where you know, intravenous bags, for instance, were difficult to produce because oil prices had gone up. And, of course, these are bags are generally made from petroleum products. And so now, all of a sudden, the price of petroleum bags has gone up in the United States. Or there is some particular pharmaceutical plant that's gone offline because of quality control problems in India. And then all of a sudden, there's a particular drug shortage at American hospitals. So it's exactly as you said when you first started this segment. It's that, you know, you start to tug on one piece, one thread, and all of a sudden, the whole thing unravels.
Right, right. So as we, you know, and this would all be kind of theoretical, but as we're looking at, for example, in Chicago, Cook County public clinics and hospitals, as you note in your story, spend about $62 million a year on medical supplies, including gloves, syringes, bags of fluids, things like that. So if, you know, have you looked at any models of if a particular country's supply chain was broken, what that might look like cost-wise?
Sure. Well, and why this is relevant today is, of course, because under the new administration, I mean, President Trump, when he was a candidate, you know, campaigned on this notion of putting a some sort of tax on goods imported from Mexico, from China, you know, as low as 20%, as high as 35%. And, you know, the way he described it on the campaign trail, it would almost be overnight, you know, that NAFTA would be ripped up, that we would all of a sudden be entering into these bilateral negotiations with China or with Mexico or with Canada. And so you know, if in fact you were to put a border adjustment tax or some other type of tariff on these products, the increase in the prices would be pretty instantaneous. And the way to think about this, and this is exactly what we talked about, I talked about with the head of the Cook County Health and Hospital System there. You know, it used to be that hospitals would have these huge warehouses where they would store masks and, you know, catheters and you name it, right? And somebody would need something, they'd go out and get it and bring it back into the hospital. Well, that, they haven't really done that in many, many years. So now they have what's called real-time delivery. So, you know, I'm a hospital in Phoenix, Arizona, and I need to have X number of catheters. I literally order those from the factory in Mexico. They get put on a truck, they're shipped to me, and they might even be in use the next day. And this is kind of good for everybody, right? Because then the hospitals aren't paying for the storage costs. They're not having to pay ahead of time for products. They only have to pay for them basically when they're getting ready to use them. So if you think about some type of tariff that's put on these kinds of products, I mean, first of all, there would be some sort of reprisal by the other countries, right? So China and Mexico, for instance, particularly Mexico, would likely put some kind of border tax then coming into Mexico. And where this starts to get even more complicated is that many of the products that are imported to the United States from Mexico actually are made from raw supplies that are coming from the United States. So a raw supplier in the United States ships something to, say, it's copper or gold or platinum. They ship that raw material to Mexico. It's essentially free of charge, right, because of NAFTA. Then the medical device manufacturer in Tijuana or Mexicali, wherever, uses that, puts it into the component again of, say, like a pacemaker. And then that pacemaker shipped back to the United States, again, essentially free of charge. So now you have to imagine that these device companies would sort of get tax coming and going, right? So those Mexico would certainly impose some sort of tariff on those raw materials coming into Mexico. And then as that product was then made whole, getting shipped back to the United States, it would be simply, it would be taxed again. So to answer your question, there aren't really necessarily models per se of how much would each individual type of product go up, because it, you know, some of it depends, right? If it's a product that's very labor intensive, so you save a lot of money on labor when you make products in Mexico. So some products that might be very labor intensive, you might save 45% on the price of your products by making it there. So any kind of tariff would affect that product differently than something that doesn't have a lot of labor costs.
Right. See, it's one of those things. Like I said, it's you tug on that little thread of that sweater, and then suddenly the whole thing starts to unravel really quickly because there's so much to it. And it gets, you wouldn't think something simple like a suturing needle or pair of latex gloves or something could be so politically charged. But indeed, here we are. So very, very interesting. Everybody head to NewYorkTimes.com and check out this story. The headline on it is "Also Made in Mexico, Life-Saving Medical Devices" by Sarah Varney. Thank you so much for being with us today, Sarah.
Thank you. Have a great day.
Thanks. You too. All right. We're going to take a little break, and when we come back, we are talking about ecotourism, and we're going to hear about the best places where we can all travel, hopefully, and think of the environment when we do so. So when we come back, we will be talking about that here on 720. WGN. It's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Wrapping things up here in just a bit, but still plenty to do, because I don't know about the restias, but I know this time of year when it starts to warm up a little bit, I start thinking about, I wonder if I can possibly carve out any time this year to take a little vacation. The answer has been no the last couple of years, but nonetheless, something we think about, and I think more and more as we're becoming aware of our carbon footprint, we want to do so responsibly. So joining us now is Liz Wessel, founder of Green Concierge Travel and Sustainable Travel Expert. Hi, Liz. Welcome to the program.
Hi, good morning, Amy.
Hi, thanks for being with us. So you founded a concierge travel that focuses on green travel. So let's define that to start out. What does that mean when we think about, you know, green tourism and ecotourism? Really, what does that encompass?
Well, there are many, many words that people are using right now, but the basic principles behind green or sustainable travel are minimizing the impact on the environment. So where you go. Protecting and respecting the natural and cultural heritage. So it's not just about the natural environment. It's also about the places that we see and visit that may be cultural and historic. And it's also about putting your money locally. Support the local communities and their economies where you visit. So look for those opportunities to stay at places where that money goes directly into people's pockets and is spent in that destination.
So not going to McDonald's in Tokyo, but going to a smaller local place instead.
Well, I find it hard to go to Tokyo and then think that you're going to eat McDonald's.
That's
and part of the adventure spirit of it is trying something new and eating local cuisine.
Yes.
And that is very popular right now, even here in the United States. People are eating local and very exciting. And so when you go somewhere else, even more so.
Definitely. I mean, that's the kind of gateway to understanding a new place is to, I don't want the tourist stuff. I don't want a big corporate meal I can eat anywhere. I want to go find some, where do people who live here eat? I want to go find those places. That seems like the way to learn about a new place. So where are the places we should be, looking at right now? I mean, the world's kind of our oyster. It's relatively easy to get just about any place right now. So what are the places that seem to be in alignment when we think about ecotourism? I know Costa Rica is a place that comes up a lot when we talk about this topic.
Right. And I just wanted to follow up on what you said, too, about when you get to a place. One of my great pieces of advice for people or my clients is start with a walking tour. Get to know the place through a guide's eyes and then expand your exploration once you've kind of done the intro through someone else's experience and a local. And, when we're thinking about places to go, so it can be anywhere from in our backyards. Like one of the best trips I've taken recently that's local was my husband and I did kind of a romantic long weekend in Memphis, and we took the train down, and then we did some local walking tours, and then we explored the place, went to hear music, and then came back. So it could be small. It could be in your backyard. But then other places people are really thinking about going, Alaska is really big on people's lists. Glacier National Park has been, and that may be linked to the global warming. People want to see some of these places before they change dramatically.
Right.
And then it gets, you're right. The world is our oyster. So you really could look around and pick almost any place and have a great sustainable tourism experience.
So when you're booking a trip, so say, okay, this is the week I'm going to go to someplace, and you've picked your destination and you've got your walking tour set up and all of those things that you recommend, what are some other things that you can do to kind of up the ante on traveling more sustainably other than, we take our flight, we go to our hotel, other than maybe trading taxis for trains, public transportation, walking, things like that. There seems like there's got to be things that aren't quite so obvious that we can do to help make our travel seem a little more sustainable.
Yeah, there's definitely things that you can start doing. So you've gone through quite a few of them, which is things that I would recommend to people. So in addition to, say, visiting a local park or some local site, don't forget to perhaps maybe drop a donation to the group that's actually maintaining and being the steward for that area. So, for example, this is a micro example. Walden Pond gets lots and lots of visitors, but there's a small local group that really makes it their business to watch out for Walden Pond. A place where you can drop some money in and, mm-hmm. Give a donation. So that's one thing to up the ante. Another might be, talking about food. And I love Chicago's, the Kendall College Culinary Institute. This is a way you can support people who are learning the trade, and they're totally committed to sustainable food and, teaching these new chefs, how to do things in a local way, work with farmers, support the local people. And so go try that. Look for a culinary institute where you can actually support the people learning how to do things.
Right.
So there's ways to go a little deeper than, what you were doing. But you were spot on a lot of them. I would say public transit's a big thing, and buses. That's where you, what we call live like a local. You're experiencing things in a local way. And that's very popular right now. That's one of the trending things. People want to get a, you know, a flat or an apartment, go to the local markets, cook some food. So that's very, very trendy right now.
Yeah. I mean, I have to say two of my favorite international travel experiences both involved just hopping on a bus and just seeing where I landed. And it ended up being very cool and off the beaten path. And it was great. And I love what you said about food, too, because, you know, something I like to do is kind of look at, and this is a topic, sustainable food systems. This is a topic that comes up a lot on this show, just because I'm personally interested in it. But I like to kind of look, especially when we're going outside of the U.S., kind of get a sense of how the food system works in that country. Even just kind of a cursory search can be really eye-opening. And I think it makes us realize how far we have to go with our own sometimes. But it is very, very interesting. Well, everybody, head to greenconciergetravel.com and you can read all about the work that Liz does as owner and founder of that and all of her expertise there as a sustainable travel expert. Thank you so much for being with us today, Liz.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Amy.
Thank you. All right. We are going to take a little break and get you to news and all that good stuff and wrap things up here on the Wintrust Business Lunch when we come back on 720 WGN.